U.S. businesses thrive on Alibaba's online marketplace, where sales by American companies to Chinese consumers added $53 billion to the U.S. economy in 2022. Discover more at AlibabaPowersBusinesses.com.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
Build Back Better takes another hit, and the Biden administration comes out for race preferences and college admissions. Hello and welcome to the Wall Street Journal's Potomac Watch. I'm Bill McGurn, filling in for Kyle Peterson, and with me today are my editorial page colleagues Kim Strassel and Jason Willick. Kim, give us a rundown of where we are on Build Back Better. Chuck Schumer, Senate Majority Leader, insists we're getting this lump of coal for Christmas, but it's harder and harder to see how that comes about.
Absolutely. And first of all, just for procedural reasons, in that, first of all, there are entire chunks of the bill that have not even been written yet. We did get a couple of committees who over the weekend put out their portions of the bill, and they were pretty sizable chunks, but the whole bill is not entirely in yet. That is in part because Democrats themselves have not decided on some major provisions, and the biggest of those being what to do with the state and local tax deduction. Bernie Sanders would like to see a smaller version of that than what came out of the House. Bob Menendez also has some concerns, another senator there. There's arguments with progressives and with those members of states that care most about this, mostly blue states like New York and New Jersey. That's a big fight, and they don't seem to be any closer to an answer. But perhaps the biggest issue that they have is that this is still going through the process where the Senate parliamentarian looks at the bill and decides whether or not it is kosher under reconciliation rules, which are quite complex. And Senator Ron Wyden, who runs the Senate Finance Committee, acknowledged that just his piece of the bill alone, which is the taxation and finance sides of this, he has 20 outstanding issues that have not been resolved with a parliamentarian. And that's before you go through some other biggies that are separate policy issues. For instance, the immigration provision, which doesn't seem like it would work, et cetera. So that's just a process level. It's really hard to see how you could work through all of that even from now between Christmas. And that's not accounting for the at least 4 or 5 days. You'd also need to have the bill on the floor to go through amendments, et cetera. And that's all before you get to the fact that Joe Manchin has still not said where he falls on this.
Jason, in the back and forth over this, one of the big developments has been the Congressional Budget Office rescoring at the request of Republicans. Republicans, I believe, asked for a scoring based on taking all the things the Democrats want to pass and assuming they're permanent rather than pretending they're temporary, which the White House wants to do. And one reason they wanted to do that is because that brings the overall price tag down. Let's play a clip first from Jen Psaki when she was asked about this new CBO scoring.
What you're talking about here is a fake CBO score that is not based on the actual bill that anybody is voting on. This was a request by Senator Graham to score a bill that is not currently being debated. That is his prerogative to do. But what our focus is on the existing bill that will lower the deficit, that will also, over an additional 10 years, pay for the $2 trillion tax cuts that Republicans didn't pay for.
Yeah, Jason, so there's two accusations here. One is the White House is saying this is a fake CBO score because of the assumptions, whereas the Republican argument has been this is kind of a fake bill because it's pretending that these programs are temporary when once you pass them, it becomes much harder to remove. Who's telling the truth here?
Well, first of all, let me go on the record saying I think there's no way this is going to be passed by Christmas. I was in Washington over the weekend, and I had some conversations, and I just doubt that the majority leader Chuck Schumer is going to be able to get a vote by that time with all the outstanding issues that Kim highlighted. On the cost, absolutely. the bill does things like extend the child allowance, basically payments to parents for only 1 year, as a compromise, to make it look like this is not a very costly measure. But then, of course, once that were set to expire, there would be huge pressure to renew it. The other thing it does is it sort of uses the state and local tax deduction to make it look like that by expanding the state and local tax deduction, Democrats are saving money, because they're comparing that to the expiration of the $10,000 cap on the deduction. Anyway, but the point being that using the 10-year budget window, there are games with the start and end dates of various programs that make it look like this bill costs, you know, is in Joe Manchin's required cost of, you know, $1.75 trillion. But if the programs were to continue, and if political inertia were to continue as we think it will, the cost will be much more. Penn Wharton said $4.6 trillion, you know, adding trillions of dollars to the deficit. So the CBO score is a, you know, the real cost, if this passes, is probably somewhere in between, because probably some of the programs will continue. Maybe some of them, depending on the outcome of elections in 2022, will be will stop. But it's clear that the price tag that the administration is touting, which, remember, they said was zero initially, is false. And also the $1.75 trillion price tag is also false. It's something more than that because of the way that the programs are structured.
Yeah, Kim, you mentioned Joe Manchin before. The remarkable thing is that the so-called smart money seems to be betting that he's going to cave on this, right? But he's more or less been consistent since the summer when he let people know his objections. And it doesn't seem to me that the new CBO score and the new evidence we're getting makes the case against him. It looks quite the other way. In fact, we have a clip. Let's play this clip, I believe, from Lindsey Graham on Joe Manchin, his colleague across the aisle.
Joe Manchin, if you're watching, you were right, Joe. You got this right. It is a lie. It's 4.9 trillion, not 1.75. Okay. It's 3 trillion. So Joe Manchin was right.
Yeah, Kim, was Joe right?
Yeah. And look, this is a big problem. Jen Psaki can try to wish it away if she was and call it fake. But the Republicans were very smart in asking for this because Joe Manchin had specifically been harping on this issue so consistently, saying that he didn't like the budget gimmicks in the bill. He actually gave a press conference just to go through that issue and his concerns with it. And he clearly did see this score and had a comment on it already this week, yesterday. And I quote him here. He said, quote, "If we don't, we're not transparent and accurate, then where does the money come from? We go back and another bite and more funding? Or do we just throw caution to the wind and have debt financing, which has been done by both parties for far too long?" End quote. And look, here's one of the problems for Democrats on this too, and the harsh reality of this CBO score is that just take two provisions. Jason had mentioned the child allowance. They're claiming it's going to be $185 billion for 1 year. If you extend it out for 10, it's actually $1.6 trillion. Similarly, their earned income tax credit, they claim it ends after 1 year at a cost of $13 billion. If you extend it out, CBO says it's $135 billion. If you add those two numbers together, the real costs over 10 years, it's $1.7 trillion, which is pretty much the top line that Joe Manchin said he'd be willing to spend for a bill. And that's with nothing else. Literally nothing else. You know, none of the climate provisions, none of the new entitlement programs they want to envision. So they have a real math problem. And I guess the question and what you pose is, does Joe Manchin now cave? He has put out so many red lines. You know, inflation and the numbers obviously came in. That was another huge blow. If you are looking to Joe Manchin to see where he's headed, that number on Friday was extraordinary. He's talked about that. He's talked about his demand that the Federal Reserve begin and end its tapering program before any of this money goes out the door. He has said he wants to wait and see how things go. Add all those things up, and it's very hard to see how he can find a way to back away from all of it. I don't think he's willing to come out right now and say this is dead. I think he's hoping, maybe in vain, for his colleagues to realize that just from a process perspective, they have a timing problem, and have Chuck Schumer finally acknowledge that reality. But I still just don't see how he ends up as a yes here, given the many demands he's outlined.
Okay, we're going to take a short break. You're listening to Potomac Watch from The Wall Street Journal.
U.S. businesses thrive on Alibaba's online marketplace, where sales by American companies to Chinese consumers added $53 billion to the U.S. economy in 2022. Discover more at AlibabaPowersBusinesses.com.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
Welcome back. I'm Bill McGurn for the Wall Street Journal's Potomac Watch. My colleague Kim Strassel and Jason Willick have been discussing the fate of Joe Biden's Build Back Better. Kim just mentioned Manchin and the reasons, you know, he's drawing all these red lines. My sense is that at this point, he would do far worse for himself by caving than by standing his line. You know, if he stands where he is, of course, a lot of the Democrats in Washington will really regard him as a traitor and so forth. But if you look at West Virginia, there was a poll about a month ago, and Joe Manchin had twice the approval ratings of Joe Biden. And also on Build Back Better, something like 74% of West Virginians were against it. So I don't see what he would gain by going along at the end. As Kim says, he's drawn so many red lines. If he gave in now, wouldn't he just communicate that I'm just like any other politician, I take a principled line, but when push comes to shove, I roll over?
Yeah, I sure hope so. And I think that polling gap between him and the president is very real. It's also exists for Kyrsten Sinema in Arizona, where she's much more popular than the president. The question is, you know, he's not up for re-election in 2022. He's up for re-election in 2024. So, you know, we don't even know if he is going to run for re-election. He's in his 70s. So the question is, does he sort of take one for the team as a Democratic partisan and show himself willing to hurt his political standing to advance this, you know, project that Democrats, you know, have a once in a generation opportunity to enact? Or is he more concerned about his political standing and sincere in his convictions? I mean, he keeps saying, including at our Wall Street Journal CEO Council meeting, things like, look, I'm not a liberal. If you guys mm-hmm. want to pass all these things, go and elect more liberals. I'm not a liberal. So it's a question of who he is, but he's really, you know, presumably on purpose, gives contradictory signals. Some days it sounds more like no. Some days it sounds like, well, it's a good talk. We're making progress. I think Kim's right that he's sort of hoping for his party to kind of awaken to their situation. But I'm glad that I don't have to put money on this one because he's hard to read.
Yeah, Kim. One thing, and then we'll wrap it up. I did want to get into inflation. The same people that told us the bill was free, had recently told us inflation really wasn't a concern or it'd be a temporary blip or something. And now it's looking troubling. If even a fraction of the new CBO scores are right about the spending, the deficit spending that it would cause, that's not good news for inflation, right? I mean, in many ways, you could look at Joe Manchin as saving the Democratic Party from heading to those rocks, because inflation is something every American feels, and you can't deny it. People go to the gas station and they fill up their tanks, and it's an extra $20, and they know. So it's hard to see how this bill, with this deficit spending, is really going to be the cure for inflation that the White House says it is.
They'd be very wise to listen to him, because what you've had in the Democratic Party now for most of this year is they're putting their hands over their ears and their eyes to the truth of the inflation threat and coming up with all kinds of excuses, which they've been selling to the public. You know, whether it's, I remember this spring, it was apparently inflation was all about surging used car prices, which they said would come down soon. You know, they're still up 31% over the year. Okay. They told us for a while it was because of, you know, supply chain pressures, and that those will ease, and that this was transitory. But, you know, we've been dealing with this supply chain problem for a while now, and nobody actually can give an honest assessment of when it would end. Will it continue on into next year? Will it continue beyond that? Nobody knows. We've been told that this is because demand for goods has surged because of people came out of their lockdowns. But, you know, a lot of people have been unlocked for a while now, and prices are still really high. I think at a certain point, you Democrats have to at least contemplate the argument that many sound economists have been making, which is that this has something more to do with the wash, and by that number, we mean $5 trillion of government dollars from the federal government that have been washed into the economy over the past 18 months. And that's what Joe Manchin has been warning his party about. He's drawn a direct line and said, I think we need to stop and see what that effect of all this prior spending has means for inflation. We need to wait in order to get that understanding. And that as a result, the worst thing we could do would be to wash another $3 or $4 trillion into the economy. So we'll see. But, you know, he's trying to save them from a fate worse than they've got now.
Right. I agree. Jason, let me switch a little bit. The Supreme Court has been in the news, you know, largely for the abortion cases and so forth. But there's another big case that's kind of under the radar and involves Harvard and its admissions. Asian Americans say that Harvard is using racial criteria to exclude highly qualified Asian American applicants. It's not a quota, but it's designed to reduce those numbers in the name of equity and so forth. So they've been suing. This suit's been going on since 2014. They lost at the district court level, I think, 2 years ago, and they lost last year at the appellate court level. Now they're asking the Supreme Court to take it up. And I'm wondering what your read of the likelihood of this is. The Supreme Court kind of punted. It said that it needed the opinion of the Solicitor General first. You know, some people think this was just so that all these huge cases didn't come, you know, at them at the same time. The Solicitor General has now weighed in, meaning the government side is now, they've taken Harvard's side in this, which is a reversal from when Donald Trump was president. Tell us where you think it is and what you think is likely, what you think the court is likely to do. Will they take the case?
Yeah, that's a good question. It looked for a moment there like we might have a trifecta of culture war cases at the Supreme Court this year with abortion, guns, and affirmative action. But you're right, the court, instead of taking the case outright, said, let's ask the Biden administration for their perspective. So they did. And as a result, this is going to be pushed back, their decision on whether to take the affirmative action case at all, whether to hear argument on it. And the Biden administration, as the court surely knew, submitted a brief saying, we think that this use of race in admissions is okay. The Grutter v. Bollinger decision and other precedents, which are kind of a mess, going back 30, 40 years, that have basically allowed affirmative action to go on in colleges that are that receive federal funds, even if it, you know, suppresses the likelihood of Asian American students being admitted. I think they're pretty likely to take it, because I think that this is a compelling case. I mean, the facts in this Harvard case that they've been able to get through discovery, you know, the admissions memos and the comments are just pretty compelling and really do show a kind of discrimination. I think, you know, the court is very sensitive right now to its legitimacy. meaning, you know, how much is it going to get beat up for involving itself in hot button political issues? But you know, I think that with this six justice conservative majority, we're going to see quite likely to see four justices willing to take this on anyway, because it's just the facts are what they are, regardless of you know what people say about the politics.
Ken, do you think this is partly the Supreme Court's own mess? I mean, Jason mentioned that it was a mess, but it's sort of a mess created by the Supreme Court. You know, going back to this Alan Bakke case when he sued the University of California after he was denied admission to med school, I think the court said quotas were not constitutional, but affirmative action was. And they've never defined it. There have been all these cases since then coming up. Jason mentioned Grutter and so forth. And, you know, one reason is they keep giving, you know, kind of muddy definitions of what's allowed and what's not allowed. John Roberts has famously said the way to stop discrimination on the basis of race is to stop discriminating by race. And so some of us are hoping that that's what they do here. But I mean, do you agree that they're likely to get this, to take this case and rule the right way finally?
Well, let's talk about why they have done that over the years. And it wasn't so much a why as a who. And it was former Justice Anthony Kennedy, who was the swing vote on that court for many, many years, and who was very committed to using affirmative action in schools. And so they never really had the ability to just draw a line under it and say, no, that was the answer to this. It's also the answer under the Constitution. We shouldn't be discriminating against anybody in anything. It should be on merit. Anthony Kennedy is now gone, obviously replaced by Brett Kavanaugh. And since then, obviously the addition of Amy Coney Barrett, that gives the court an extraordinary new opportunity to just completely, revamp the landscape for, these racial preferences cases, and do the right thing. The question, as you brought up in the beginning, is does it have the stomach to do that, especially in a year, and particularly given that they've also got a big gun case in front of them, obviously abortion cases in front of them. It's a little concerning that their request went out for the Solicitor General opinion, because it suggests it wants an excuse not to do this, but you never know. And reading those tea leaves is tough. So let's just hope that even in light of this, it decides to move ahead.
Okay, Kim, I think I'm going to have to leave you with the last word. We'll end it there. You've been listening to the Wall Street Journal's Potomac Watch with Bill McGurn, Kim Strassel, and Jason Willick. Please come back tomorrow for another edition.
U.S. businesses thrive on Alibaba's online marketplace, where sales by American companies to Chinese consumers added $53 billion to the U.S. economy in 2022. Discover more at alibabapowersbusinesses.com.